In this hour of midday, a story of espionage and sabotage from Baltimore 100 years ago during World War I. Paul Hilken ran the Baltimore office of the North German Lloyd steamship line from a building that still stands at North Charles and Redwood. Paul Hilken was an American citizen and a prominent businessman, but he had a secret life in Germany's most successful sabotage cell in the U.S. He helped German agents carry out attacks on munitions factories, depots, and ships, including a massive explosion at a place on the New Jersey waterfront known as Black Tom. Coming up, historian Dwight Messemer on Paul Hilken and the Baltimore Sabotage Cell, after the news. And welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us. In this second hour of the show, the story of a prominent and wealthy Baltimore businessman who, 100 years ago, helped German agents carry out acts of sabotage on the east coast of the United States. Paul Hilken was his name, but to his co-conspirators, he was known as the von Hindenburg of Roland Park. According to our guest this hour of the show, Paul Hilken had a secret life as the head of Germany's most effective sabotage cell in the U.S. He helped German agents sabotage the supply line of munitions across the Atlantic by planning attacks on factories, depots, and ships in 1916. One of those attacks, the largest and most famous, occurred at a place known as Black Tom on the New Jersey waterfront. It was a massive explosion of some 2 million pounds of munitions awaiting shipment to France and England. The blast at Black Tom shattered windows in lower Manhattan, and some people in northern Maryland even claimed to have heard and felt the explosion. This was before the U.S. agreed to help the British and French fight the Germans in the Great War in Europe that became known as World War I. Dwight Messemer joins us to tell us the story of Paul Hilken. His new book, published by the Naval Institute Press in Annapolis, describes in rich detail how Germany broke the British blockade of the Atlantic with cargo submarines, or U-boats, while also carrying out dozens of acts of sabotage with sympathizers here in Baltimore. The book is called The Baltimore Sabotage Cell, German Agents, American Traitors, and the U-Boat Deutschland During World War I. An Army veteran and former lecturer in history at California State University, San Jose, Dwight Messemer has for years been fascinated with submarine warfare in World War I. That interest brought him to the Port of Baltimore and this story of Paul Hilken. So thank you very much for joining us, Dwight Messemer. It's a pleasure to get you on our show.
Thanks a lot, Dan. Glad to be here.
Let's set the stage a bit. Let's go to the year 1915. The war began in August 1914. The U.S. was not involved up to that point yet. The British had established a blockade of ships, a blockade of the German ships, so that the Germans had a tough time getting supplies into their country, imports into Germany. And the Germans set out to devise a way to break that blockade. That's sort of where your story begins.
Yes, it does. The blockade actually, the blockade was not just to blockade ships. It was a siege of Germany. And right. The Royal Navy was used to seal off all ocean access, with the exception of the Baltic, all ocean access to Germany. And it was very, very efficient. And by the spring of 1915, for all practical purposes, nothing got into Germany and nothing got out. And the Germans were in serious trouble by the spring of 1915, both in through shortages of war materials. They needed munitions. They needed nickel badly. They needed copper. They needed rubber. They needed everything they could get. And they were starting to have a food problem, too. The big problem for the Germans was they couldn't trade with the United States as long as the British blockade was in place. And there were only three ways they could defeat the blockade. One was to sort of blow their way through it, mm-hmm. but they didn't have the naval horsepower to do that. The other options would be to fly over, but of course airplanes weren't technologically capable of doing something like that, and they couldn't carry the loads anyway. And the third opportunity was to go under it. So they had members of the German government and German industry had talked about methods of building U-boats to, or even taking war boats and converting them to cargo carriers. It wasn't a new idea. But it in 1915, Krupp said that he would build his own boat. And he commissioned one of his senior engineers to design what at the time was an enormous submarine.
This would be a surprise.
Purely for cargo.
This would be a surprise. Yeah, purely for cargo. This is what it was a surprise eye-opener for me, because we associate U-boats with warfare. Here were U-boats designed, starting with the Deutschland, a submarine designed to just break a blockade, actually to go under the blockade. And the U.S. was still trading with Germany, even though there was a war on in Europe, right?
Well, they weren't actually trading with the Germans because they couldn't. The Americans wanted aniline dyes from Germany. Germany was about the only country that produced aniline dyes of high quality and in the quantity that the Americans wanted and could use.
Scott, I'm sorry, Dwight. What did they want?
Aniline dyes. They were fabric dyes.
American
fabric industry, the things that make your shirt yellow, green, blue, whatever.
Okay. So let me understand then. There was... The U.S. didn't trade with Germany, or
they couldn't. They couldn't. There was no the British even stopped the mail. You couldn't mail a letter to Germany.
But if a German ship, in this case a submarine, could get to an American port, trade could still be conducted.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
Okay.
And that was the whole issue, was that the Americans said, hey, we're not being one sided with this business of providing the British with munitions and supplies and things. We'll give them to you too, but you don't have any ships.
Okay.
And the submarine would have solved that problem.
So you get a submarine that goes under the British blockade, gets to the United States. Okay, that's part of the plan. The other part of the plan is Germany's over there thinking, well, the British and the French can still get raw materials and munitions from the United States. We need to do something about that. And that's what gets us to Paul Hilken and what became known as the Baltimore Sabotage Cell. Dwight?
Right. Yeah. The situation was to break the blockade with this submarine on one hand, and on the other hand, to interrupt the supply line from the United States to Britain, however they could. The agencies that handled those two separate but somewhat related programs were naval intelligence on one hand, the submarine, and German army intelligence on the other, the sabotage. Paul Hilken was a Baltimore businessman. He and his father owned A. Schumacher and Company, which is a tobacco import company. But Paul Hilken was also the American agent for North German Lloyd Lines, in Baltimore. And he, interestingly, too, he was also the vice Swedish consul in Baltimore. The German Navy throughout the world their intelligence unit was called, part of it was called the Etappendienst, means supply service. And they were the ones that were actually behind this cargo U-boat program. They saw to the funding. They drew the German sailors out of the U-boats themselves and made them look like commercial merchant seamen, gave them merchant seamen identification. Hmm. They established a dummy shipping company under the auspices of North Deutsche Lloyd or North German Lloyd that was called Deutsche Ocean Reederei, which is a German navigation company. And this intelligence group was already connected with Paul Hilken because he was part of North German Lloyd. It's vague, but once you get into it, you really understand how this guy fit in there.
Mm-hmm.
They called him home, not home. They called him back to Germany in February 1916, and as an American, because he was an American, he could travel on a neutral passenger ship through the British blockade into Norway or Sweden or Denmark even, and then come down into Germany, which is what he did. He went to Bremen and he got his marching orders from the German Navy on this U-boat operation. His job was to come back to Baltimore and build a company called the Eastern Forwarding Company, EFCO, we call it. And he was to rent or buy land. He was to incorporate the company, and that everything a businessman would do is setting up a shipping company.
So he's going to help them. He's going to help them with the submarine, the cargo submarines.
Oh yeah, he's going to manage the cargo at that end of the line. DOR will ostensibly will run the line from Germany just like a steamship line, and EFCO, or Eastern Forwarding Company in Baltimore, will be the receiving agents for the cargo at this end.
Okay.
And they'll see who gets to the right people. And it was strictly a business, looked like a business deal.
Right.
And that's the way it was sold to the world. And the Americans bought it, looked good to them. The guy that ran the German end of the thing was a very prominent German businessman named Alfred Lohmann. So it looked to be completely above board. And the German Navy made sure that there was never any mention of their involvement in that program. But while Hilken was in Berlin getting his directions from the Navy through North German Lloyd, he also went to Berlin and he met with a section of German Army intelligence called Section Politik. And they were exclusively tasked with the job of sabotage operations worldwide. And he attended a meeting with them, and they explained to him what they wanted done, and they provided him with the means to do it and the money. The reason he was in Berlin, the reason they knew him, is that in 1915, when Franz von Rintlen arrived in the United States, he was a German naval officer who was sent here by the espionage people, by the sabotage people, to establish three cells in the United States, New York, Baltimore, and New Orleans. And he did. And he Paul Hilken was the guy he tapped in Baltimore to run one of these cells. So the Section Politik in Berlin already knew about him. So they brought him, they trained, they told him what they wanted, they gave him everything he needed, including $500,000 in funds, and sent him back home.
Okay.
When he got home.
Dwight, hold on, because we're going to have to take a break here in a minute in our story.
Okay.
So I just want to establish this. So Paul Hilken, he's of German ancestry, but he's an American citizen. He's from Baltimore, which is full of German Americans and German immigrants who have come over here since the middle of the 19th century. And he's sympathetic to the fatherland, the motherland. He's the Kaiser, right? He thinks he's...
And
the United States has not declared war yet. This is still 1915, 1916, this is happening.
Right.
And so in that atmosphere, and he's... You describe him as a bit of a... Not a completely honest fellow. And he liked a story. He liked women, and he liked to tell a story. So he probably found some of this really cool and romantic, didn't he?
Oh, he did.
Yeah.
Yeah. But more importantly, this guy really wanted to help the Germans, the German cause. He believed that they should be the ones to win the war. And he wasn't alone in that. There are a lot of people over here who felt that way.
Yeah. All right, Dwight, we'll take our first break here. Dwight Messimer, his book is The Baltimore Sabotage Cell, German Agents, American Traitors, and the U-Boat Deutschland During World War I. We'll get a chance to hear more about this fellow, Paul Hilken, who was known as the von Hindenburg of Roland Park among his co-conspirators. More with Dwight when we get back. And this is Midday. Dan Rodericks here. We're really bringing you two stories this hour. One story about Germany's effort to break the British Royal Navy's blockade of the Atlantic, of Atlantic shipping, by using cargo U-boats or submarines during World War I. The other is the effort to commit acts of sabotage to break supply lines, supplies of raw materials and munitions from the United States to England and to France. And the man at the center of that story is a Baltimore man named Paul Hilken, a Baltimore businessman, pretty wealthy one too, pretty prominent with his father, ran the North German Lloyd and Hamburg American Steamship Lines out of a building that still stands in Baltimore at Charles or South Charles. I misspoke earlier and said North Charles. South Charles and Redwood Street. Redwood Street, once upon a time, was known as German Street. That name was changed. But if you go down there, you'll see this building described in the Baltimore Sun once as a Renaissance-style Hansel and Gretel-like structure at Redwood and South Charles called Hansa House. And that was the headquarters of the German North German Lloyd line. That's where Paul Hilken and his father went to work. But that's also where Paul Hilken hatched some plans with his collaborators to commit acts of sabotage on the East Coast. The Baltimore Sabotage Cell is Dwight Messemer's book on this, German Agents, American Traitors, and the U-Boat Deutschland during World War I. So, Dwight, back to our story. Hansa House, I just mentioned there, that actually was a place where these saboteurs made their plans.
Yes, meetings were held on the third floor. Hilken kept everything up there that pertained to the operation. When we left and took that break, I wanted to tell you that Hilken, when he was back in Baltimore, this is a man now, he wore two hats. On one hand, he was a civilian agent for what appeared to be legitimate submarine cargo shipping line. On the other hand, he was a German agent involved in sabotage. The two operations were kept completely separate, and Hilken and later when Friedrich Hinsch and the other people that worked with him were very careful not to bring the two together because the cargo submarine project was so fragile anyway and very important to them. When Hilken went to German Army Intelligence Headquarters in Berlin in February 1916 to be briefed and provided with what he needed for sabotage operations, the people at North German Lloyd and in German Naval Intelligence had no idea he was there. And as far as I know, they never did find out until after the war that he'd been, you know, involved with the other side, so to speak. So he was running a really risky game in Baltimore, trying to work both sides of the street at the same time.
Right.
Also, right.
Yeah, just a little bit of background on Paul Hilken. He went to Baltimore City College, Lehigh University, also to MIT, eventually worked for his father. Did his father have anything to do with the sabotage?
No. No, Henry, he knew about it because Henry was very, very strongly pro-German, but he knew about it, but he wasn't involved in it in any way.
Dwight, I need to ask
you. I
want to ask you this about Paul and the word traitor. German agents, American traitors, using the word traitor in the subhead subtitle of your book.
Mm-hmm.
Someone might say, well, the U.S. hadn't declared war yet. So were his actions traitorous in helping Germany in this way?
He was not committing treason until April 6th, 1917. After we declared war, then he became a traitor because he was still doing it. They didn't do any more sabotage in the United States. They all got out of the country when we went to war with Germany. But he continued to fund operations in South America and Mexico. So in that sense, yes, he was guilty. That's why he didn't want to come forward and testify in 1928. And again in 30, because he was afraid he'd be prosecuted for that wartime activity.
Okay, thank you for that. Well, we'll go back to 1916 then. We ought to talk about some of these plots and these acts of sabotage that maybe today we'd call acts of terror. And eventually we'll get to Black Tom. I'm sure it won't take us long to get to the story of the Black Tom explosion. But there were various acts carried out on the East Coast.
Go ahead.
You know, I want you to describe them for us.
Okay.
Please.
Well, what they did, the way it started out, they fomented strikes. They established a dummy trade union in Baltimore called the Russian Workers Union, I think it was. And they used it as a front so that they could hand out strike notices and things and kind of stir unrest. They were very, very effective at doing that. Baltimore and B&O Railroad was plagued with strikes that Hilken and his crew motivated. Then in October, I think it was October 1915, another U.S. citizen, a physician, Dr. Anton Dilger, came back from Germany. He had been serving in the German army as a medic, as a doctor, and had joined the sabotage section of the German army intelligence in 1915, and they sent him to the United States with anthrax and Glandier's cultures, with the direction that he was to set up a lab in somewhere in the Baltimore area. He was to contact Paul Hilken, and he would get funding from him and any support that he needed.
Let's talk about this for a minute. Anthrax, a lot of people will know, dreaded anthrax from after 9/11. Shortly after that, we heard a lot about anthrax.
Yeah.
Glanders, I have it as it's a fatal horse disease, and it is communicable to humans. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah, I think they both are, actually.
So this fellow, Anton Dilger, he's an American educated doctor that specialized in wound surgery at Johns Hopkins.
Right.
He comes back and he's going to get involved in this, what, sort of biological sabotage?
Biological warfare, in a sense.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, he's going to be the guy who makes the stuff. And they set up a courier service, and as he manufactured it, they were sort of a glass tube with a needle in it. They would be packaged up, and they would be taken down to Baltimore and given to Paul Hilken, and he would turn them over to his right-hand man, Friedrich Hinch, who was a North German Lloyd captain whose ship was interned, the Necker, was interned in Baltimore.
What did they do with the anthrax, Dwight?
Well, they had three black stevedores. Eddie Felton was the straw boss. They had three black stevedores, each who organized a sort of a small squad. And they were the ones that received these glass bottles or glass tubes with a big needle in them. And they would fan out and they would go to wherever there were horses or mules, what they called remounts, that were being gathered up to be shipped to the Allies for remounts. You know, World War One was a horse-drawn war.
Right, I know. So these poor horses and mules, they're getting ready to ship them over to England and France for use in the war against Germany, and they're going to poison them with anthrax?
Yeah. So they would go to the pens or the corrals where these animals were being held, and they would get to go at night. And they blended in because they looked like stevedores or people who should be working there. And they would stab these animals in the leg or in the shoulder and trying to infect them. And in some cases, they actually poured the stuff out of the bottle into their feed, trying to infect them that way. And they did that. They carried those operations in an area from New York clear down to Savannah, Georgia.
Wow. They
did it from April 1915 to April 1917.
You mentioned Eddie Felton. That was J. Edward Felton, foreman of this African-American, all African-American stevedores gang that worked on this. Actually, am I correct that the Deutschland, the U-boat you write about in the book, it's on the cover of your book, actually, all the stevedores were black that worked on that sub when it was here?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And there was a racial reason for that, actually. The Germans were absolutely convinced that the British had spies in every major ocean port in the United States, and they were worried that they would sneak these guys in among the they hired white stevedores. They would sneak them in among the stevedores, and they would do damage to the boat. So the solution was they just hired African Americans, because they didn't think that any of them could possibly be spies or sabotage, could work for the British. And one of the funny stories about that is Paul Koenig was called to task because there's generally public outrage that these guys were being used for that purpose, to unload and load the German, the Deutschland. And the problem was, on one hand, they took away the jobs from white stevedores, and that was unthinkable. And then the other part was that they were afraid that there would be a crime wave in Baltimore with all these African Americans being imported in to work the docks down there. Both, of course, are totally unfounded.
Let me ask you about Eddie Felton's squad, as you call it. In addition to distributing this and using this anthrax and glanders against the horses and mules, were they also involved in planting bombs?
Oh, yes.
Talk about that?
He had another squad that did that.
They planted bombs on ships?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they were actually incendiary devices. They were capillary incendiary device, and they had acid in one end of it and usually potash in the other end, and with a thin plate, metal plate, in between the two halves of the tube. And they would just place these things in strategically in the hold where there was a lot of combustible material there. And these were talking about ships with munitions on board, so when that caught fire, they blew up.
Mm-hmm.
But the time delay on the thing was based on how long it took the acid to eat through the metal disc. So, I mean, it should have been several days. Once in a while, there was one that it didn't work like it was supposed to, and it ate through the disc right away. In one case, the guy was carrying them in sort of a burlap bag over his shoulder, sort of like a duffel bag or a tote today. And one of these things went off. Of course, it set the bag on fire, scared him halfway. Listen, he threw it in the bay, never went back to work again. But so they were dangerous to work with. They were really dangerous to work with. But yes, they used African-American stevedores because they trusted them. They didn't think that they would tell on them.
Right.
And if they did, they didn't think they'd be able to do a good job of it.
So, Dwight, we're going to take another break here, but before we do, I just want to sort of reset the picture here a little bit. You've got Paul Hilken, the Baltimorean, who lives in Roland Park, a pretty well-to-do, prominent businessman in Baltimore, who's serving as paymaster and plotter with these other saboteurs, carrying out these operations from Hansa House in downtown Baltimore. You've got him, and he's got these squads. He's got other saboteurs working for him. And he's got money from the German government, and he's paying them out. And you would say before we get to Black Tom, which is the big bang in this, that there were, we would say, literally dozens of operations carried out on the East Coast that would be acts of sabotage.
That would be easy to say. It's the squads were busy all the time.
Okay.
They because of the blockade, they didn't have a lot of work on the waterfront anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So this was a full-time job and better pay than they got before the war.
Dwight Messemer is our guest here on Midday. His book, a new book, The Baltimore Sabotage Cell, German Agents, American Traitors, and the U-Boat Deutschland During World War I, the Naval Institute Press in Annapolis published Dwight's book. More on this intriguing story of the saboteurs in Baltimore in World War I when we get back. Paul Hilken was an American citizen and Baltimore businessman, but he had a secret life in Germany's most successful sabotage cell in the United States during World War I. He helped German agents carry out attacks on munitions factories, depots, and ships, including a massive explosion at a place on the New Jersey waterfront known as Black Tom. Historian Dwight Messemer has written about Paul Hilken and the Baltimore Sabotage Cell. In fact, that's the title of Dwight's book, The Baltimore Sabotage Cell, German Agents, American Traitors, and the U-Boat Deutschland during World War I. The U-Boat Deutschland actually came to Baltimore. But I want to talk about Black Tom now, Dwight, and I'd like to hear you describe what happened there for us, July 20th, 1916.
Well, Black Tom was the largest munitions depot in the world at the time. The amount of explosives, ready-to-go explosives that were there were in the hundreds of thousands of tons. Some were in barges anchored there at their harbor for delivery to the ships and the main harbor, somewhere in the freight yards. It was just stuff was everywhere. And Black Tom was not very well guarded. They had, as I recall, on that particular night, they had a private security guard there, and they had a fire watch of some kind, five or six guys who were keeping a fire watch. It was fire was the thing they worried the most. And we don't know exactly who got in there to do it. It was either a fellow named Fred Herrmann or it could have been Frederick Hinch, too, and then another guy that may have been involved. There were just two of whoever it was probably two people. And they got in through this sort of a non-existing fence affair that wouldn't keep a cat or a dog out, and got in there with it. And they had these delayed action incendiary devices, and they planted them in the boxcars. They actually went after the boxcars on the railroad because they were the easiest to get to. And the night watchmen, the fire guards, had put out smudge pots because to keep the mosquitoes away from them. So these smudge pots were burning all over the place. And they planted these incendiary devices just inside the freight cars. They didn't have to open the door very far to get through there and get the device inside. And then they went down the road. A little after they got away, a little while later, someone spotted a fire that starting in one of the boxcars. And he sounded the alarm, and then people began to get away. There weren't very many people there, but those who were there didn't hang around to see if the fire was going to spread very far. They got away. And then by the time the fire department was getting wound up to go do something about it, the fire really took off. And, of course, when the explosion happened, why, it was a chain reaction. And I've heard that it was something like 6 or 7 on the Richter scale, as you know, far away as 100 miles. I don't know if that's true or not, but it's a sort of thing that indicates how powerful that blast was.
Well, some of the descriptions we hear about the reaction or people feeling this and hearing this explosion, plate glass windows breaking in Times Square, passengers on subway cars in New York hanging on for dear life, the cars swaying on their tracks. We hear about some damage done to the Statue of Liberty, which wasn't that far away from there, really. And then people in Delaware and Maryland saying that they felt and heard this explosion at Black Tom. It's clear to everybody that Paul Hilken had something to do with this.
Oh, he said he did.
He said he did.
There's no doubt about it.
He admitted to it later.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Did anything ever happen to Paul Hilken in terms of criminal prosecution?
No. He was never.
Why is that, Dwight?
Okay. Paul was an extraordinarily lucky person on one hand. On the other hand, he had a gift of talking his way out of a pickle. So a couple of times that they got really close to him, he was able to talk his way out of it, so to speak, or turn them away from him. But the way he came out, after the war, the United States and Germany organized a thing called a Mixed Claims Commission, and it was set up to determine if Germany had to pay reparations to American companies or American citizens, for that matter, for Germany's conduct during the war. And two of the cases that were brought before the Mixed Claims Commission was Black Tom, and another one, the Kingsland Fire, which Hilken and his crew were also responsible for.
Let's just mention that. That's Kingsland, New Jersey. 500,000 3-inch shells exploded after a fire at a munitions plant at the Canadian Car and Foundry Plant, Kingsland, New Jersey. I have that as January 11th, 1917.
That's right.
Okay, so that's the other. They made a major claim on that one as well. And by the time Hitler was chancellor, he paid up some of this?
No, he didn't.
He didn't.
Are you kidding?
No? I don't know. What happened?
They didn't get paid off until the Bundesrepublik, the new German government, finally settled the debt after the war.
Oh, okay.
I think it was in 1957.
Oh, okay. Okay. Nothing criminal ever came of with Paul Hilken, and you said that April 6th, 1917, that's when the U.S. actually declared war and got into the war. There were some more acts of sabotage. And did Hilken flee? Did he go somewhere?
Well, no. Actually, the sabotage stopped. There was no German sabotage after we got into the war. And there are a couple of reasons for that, which we probably don't have time to talk about right
okay,
now.
Okay, I was a little confused because when I asked you before whether he was a traitor, you said acts after a declaration of war would have been treasonous. I thought that's what you said.
Yes. Well, yes. They didn't have to be a sabotage in the United States. As long as he is a United States citizen and he's aiding and abetting the enemy, which he was,
because
he was acting as their paymaster for the spreading of anthrax in Argentina. Had a German agent down there. They called him Adams. He was heavily funding Hinch, his ex-right-hand man, and Fred Herman, one of his best operatives, who had both gone to Mexico. Herman was supposed to set fire to the Tampico oil fields, and Hinch was supposed to outfit a sort of armed privateer to raid, the munition ships and cause trouble along the west coast.
I see it now. So Hilken continued in this role after. Okay, but nothing.
Sure.
He never went to prison.
No, because he didn't get caught.
Right.
What happened was, make a long story very short, is the Bureau of Investigation, which was a forerunner of the FBI, got onto him, but they weren't interested in sabotage or espionage. Their whole thing was neutrality violation. So they chased him around trying to catch him on a neutrality violation, and they got close a couple of times just to uncover him, but they never actually got him. So,
I need to ask you this about Paul Hilken, because this is an interesting character. And by the way,
we
found your photographs of him in the book. There's lots of photographs in Dwight's book, The Baltimore Sabotage Cell. We posted some on the Dan Roderick's Facebook page. If you want to get a look at Paul Hilken and the man we didn't even mention, Paul Koenig of the Deutschland, also prominent in these photographs. But, you get just from the photographs, you get a bit from about Paul Hilken's personality, his style, a kind of a wheeler dealer. You get that just from kind of mischievous. You get that from his photographs. What I was going to say was he sort of a hero, anti-hero in the German American community in Maryland, in Baltimore?
Well, I think he was highly respected
But when they found out he was a saboteur, not everybody condemned him for that.
Well, I don't know. He didn't come out until it was 1928 when he was finally exposed.
Mm-hmm.
Things had changed. He changed by that time too, and other things had changed. I don't know. But he was at the time and during the war, he was a very highly respected member of the community, and he stayed that way. I don't think he would have been caught, but.
I see. Okay. So, people, aside from his cell here, people really didn't know what he was up to, even though there was a lot of sympathy for Germany before the U.S. got into the war.
Well, nobody had there wasn't a hint that this guy was involved in a sabotage operation. I mean, his was the most efficient, most effective sabotage cell in the United States. The federal government never got a whiff of him. They closed the one down in New York. They got it in April 1916, and that rattled some cages in Baltimore. But they never got close to the Baltimore people. Never.
What a story! What a story, Dwight.
Oh, it's a great story.
Yeah.
And how he got caught?
We're down to our last minute here.
Okay, here we go. Amos Peasley, the attorney for the plaintiffs in the Mixed Claims Commission case against Germany, stumbled onto Hilken's name in the records of the Room 40, the British code breakers, and they had broken all the German Navy code, and that's where they got Hilken's name. And so when Peasley got hold of Hilken and braced him about it and ultimately offered him immunity from prosecution, Hilken rolled over and told it all.
Maybe he liked to brag a little bit too.
If you read the testimony he gave during the Mixed Claims Commission, you're right. He did. He thought he'd done a great job, and when the Germans tried to make him out a liar, it made him so mad he went back home to Baltimore and went in his third floor office, and he found stuff that he'd hidden from everybody, even his wife didn't know about. And he brought it out.
He brought it out to prove it here. See, I ran the most effective German sabotage cell during World War I. Paul Hilken. Dwight Messemer, has been a pleasure to have you on our show. Dwight Messemer is a U.S. Army veteran, former lecturer in history at California State University, San Jose. He's written a couple of earlier books on submarine warfare in World War I. This one, published by the Naval Institute Press in Annapolis, is The Baltimore Sabotage Cell, German Agents, American Traitors, and the U-Boat Deutschland During World War I, with lots of photographs. Thank you very much, Dwight.
Hey, thank you.
Yeah,
enjoyed it.
And same here.